In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about the President of the United States, George W. Bush, and his youth and all the things that happened to him before he ran for President of the United States. Our guest for the program is Bill Minutaglio. He currently is a national contributing writer at Talk Magazine. He's also a special writer for the Dallas Morning News. His work has appeared in many magazines and newspapers, including New York Times, the LA Times, Outside, and Details, among others. He's also a national contributing writer to the Sporting News. He's the author of a biography of George W. Bush. The book was first published in 1999 and now has been republished in an updated edition, including a little bit of new material that reflects the election that we've just had. It's now out in paperback, published by Three Rivers Press. So if you're interested in reading it, it is out there. And of course, as we talk, you're welcome to call in if you have questions, comments. All we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief so that we can accommodate as many different folks as possible. But anybody's welcome to call 333-9455 for Champaign Urbana and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Minutaglio, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us today.
Glad to be with you.
So how long would you say you had been, as a reporter, had been following Mr. Bush?
I've been following him, strictly speaking, probably for the last 6 years. I've been aware of him, certainly, in Texas for longer than that. I've been based as a journalist here in Texas for almost a quarter century. And so I've been aware of he and his family for a long time, and I've kept an eye on them in a sense, and I've written about them in different shapes and forms. But in terms of strictly covering him as an elected official and really as a public figure, it's been over the last 6 years.
Hmm. Well, supposing that, say, 10 years ago, I had said to you that in 2001, George W. Bush was going to be president of the United States, would you have either applauded my foresight or would you have told me I was nuts?
I think probably somewhere in the middle. I'm going to sound like a politician and go for that middle, let's not offend anybody's zone. But, you know, you can never bet against the Bushes. And this is, I'm talking through the benefit of retrospect here and all that I've learned about this family and how powerful they are and really how well they are at planning. I do maintain in my book, and I see nothing to steer me away from not thinking this today, that George W. was born into a political family and that his route was almost predestined. I don't know whether they sat around around the crib and said, this boy is going to be the president someday, but I think he knew early on, the family knew early on, that he was going to get into a life in politics. It's really just what the Bushes do. They do business and they do politics. They do both very well. That's not an analysis of their philosophies or public policies, but they obviously succeed in both arenas very well. So I would have agreed with you. I think I would have said there's a good chance. I would have probably have said, you know, there might be other guys in the family, notably his brother Jeb, who might actually get to the starting line before George W. But obviously he's he's now the president.
Mm-hmm. It seems a couple of things that seem to come through. One is that he certainly feels a responsibility to, in a sense, uphold the family name because his father and his grandfather, other Bushes, have achieved much, and he seemed to feel that it was his responsibility, in a sense, to do that. But it also seems to be the case that he is concerned with being his father's equal. And the thing that I wonder is whether he's doing that for himself, that is, he wants to see himself as his father's equal, or he's trying to gain his father's approval.
I'm going to flatter you right off the bat, which is always a good thing to do with someone who's interviewing you, but I couldn't agree with you more, and it's a wonderful analysis. I happen to think that the best prism through which to view George W. is his family, and particularly his father. And I actually further maintain that it's a way to begin to understand his public policies and where he'll take us, not just simply as maybe a fascinating psychological portrait of a powerful public figure, but really as well a way to begin understanding where George W. is coming from, what he's going to do for the country or do to the country if you're a critic of his. And that I have also lately come to the thought that George W. Not only has his entire life been defined by his relationship with his father, the sense that he's trying to embrace his father's legacy, capitalize on it, but at the same time shake it off so that he could be viewed as his own man. I think that George W. as a figure in history now really won't rest easy until he's actually able to surpass his father. He's finally, this late in his life, achieved equal footing with his father, and I think he really wants to go the next step. After being measured so often with his dad, I think he wants to prove that he can accomplish things in office that his father was never able to tackle. And I think really what he wants is to get reelected. I know that's fairly premature. We're only 1 week into a new administration. But I do believe, and I've heard this from some members of the family and some of his friends, George W., an intensely competitive man, a guy who's been nagged by we in the media in terms of comparisons to his father. Are you riding your dad's coattails? Are you, do you have the gravitas, the really true transcendent presidential aura to be in that office? Are you still just his son, still just the first son? I think he'll truly only rest easy when he's reelected and he can turn to his dad at these sort of famous family gatherings in Kennebunkport every August and say, "Dad, I finally one-upped you."
Yeah. Well, it's interesting to read about the differences between George W.'s mother and father and how they reacted to, as they called him, Little George, his misbehavior. His mom was the one who would yell. But the worst thing, apparently, that that his dad could do is just to say, sort of in a very quiet way, something like, "Son, I'm very disappointed in you." And that, apparently, for George W., was worse than being smacked.
Yeah, no, absolutely. His mother was really kind of the overt, out front, symptomatic person who would issue behavior modification, as George W. liked to call it. She was almost the bad cop, if you will, and his father was the good cop. And his form of discipline was really, again, through almost a world-weary sense of disappointment. "You've let me down. Mm-hmm. I don't need to talk to you. My expectations for you are unspoken, but also very, very powerful." George W. said at one moment, he is not a truly intensely self-reflective man. The Bushes, by and large, as a clan, were raised to not be that way. They don't like to put themselves on the couch. So when, on occasion, they do kind of open up and talk about what's in their inner soul or their core, it's wise to pay attention. And several years ago, George W. said, I never really had a real soul-bearing talk with my father. He never really told me what his expectations were for me. And he even went further on and said that he and his father never even really had the talk that some fathers and sons have about the birds and the bees, the talk, as George W. described it. And there was a lot of almost an awkward relationship between the two as George W. was being raised. There was certainly a lot of love and affection and support, but not a lot of that very detailed kinds of sense of expectation that was conveyed to George W. But most people in the family have told me that the father never really had to spell it out. It hadn't had to be put in conversation or even on paper in some way. It was unspoken. It was so obvious. It was like an invisible sign, excuse me, at the side of the road. You will essentially follow your dad. You're going to go into a life similar to his at the upper realms of finance and politics. And you know that's coming. That's what we expect of you. It's just what the Bushes do. And we'll see how you handle it.
Our guest here on Focus 580 is Bill Minutaglio. He's a Texas-based journalist. He's worked for papers in Abilene and San Antonio and Houston and Dallas. Since 1983, he's been a special writer at the Dallas Morning News, and he is the author of a biography of George W. Bush. The title of his book is First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. It's now been republished, actually, in paperback by Three Rivers Press. The book first came out in, I think, in the fall of 1999, or maybe it was in the late summer.
It was in the fall of 99.
In the fall of 99. And the questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in your perspective as somebody who grew up in New York and then transplanted to Texas. I know you went to, you grew up in New York and went to college there, and then now have been in Texas for a while. And I think in a sense it maybe reflects a little bit of the Bush experience, where with a family that had these roots in the East and moved west. George the elder never made a very convincing Texan, but George W. really identified with that. And at the same time, it seemed to be he was really wrestling with these sort of these two poles that that make up the family identity, that is the Texas and the oil business, and yet and the quote unquote, you know, Eastern establishment. How do those two things balance out in George W. Bush?
You know, I was talking to someone the other day about what is unique about the Bush political dynasty. The Bushes, by the way, really loathe that word. They don't like the word dynasty. George W. says it connotes inheritance and a sense of being given something without actually earning it. And that obviously can be debated till the, you know, the cows come home in Texas as it applies to George W., whether he earned or inherited what he's gotten through life. But you know, they really are an interesting family in the sense that they are a true dynasty, and that they have transcended some of the dynastic inclinations of other families who remain in maybe one part of the country or one region or even one state. You know, they're all over the map now. They're in Florida. They're in Texas. They have roots in Ohio and up through the Midwest, and they're sprinkled here and there around the country. It's a surprisingly diverse clan and a quietly powerful clan. I think they have also been very, very good at identifying places in the United States through the course of this family's history where true big-time financial opportunity would await them. When the Bushes sensed that the country was pushing out to the west, or observed along with everyone else that it was, they became interested in steel and railroad and had extensive holdings and operations in the Midwest, and they were there for that kind of financial or industrial thunderclap in American history. When they sensed and observed along with many other people that there was a second oil wave emerging in Texas, they dispatched the elder, George Bush, to Texas with family money to basically do the best that he could to suck that one big natural resource that we have down here out of the ground. So they've been very, very good at identifying places. And of course, oil is what brought them to Texas, big-time money. George W. was not born in Texas. He was born in New Haven, Connecticut. And despite that fact, as they say down here, he managed to get elected in Texas. This is a very xenophobic state. And you're right, in my tiny way, I don't pretend to ever relate to the Bush family. They just move in different circles than I do. But I know about what it's like to be a transplanted a New Yorker winding up in Texas. You have to be here a little bit and adopt a few of the customs, so to speak, in a place that at one time, you know, used to be its own country, and people still talk about Texas as the Republic of Texas and how all life ends on the other side of the Red River in some way. George W. worked very, very hard. He become a Texan, he does have certainly more authentic Texas leanings. He went to a grade school here, and a lot of his friends and reference points are here. But make no mistake about it, this is a guy that moves very easily in many different circles and is exposed to many different things. Not many Texas, you know, grade school children zip off to Phillips Andover Academy, perhaps the most prestigious private boarding school in the U.S., and then on to Yale, and then on to Harvard, and so forth. His parents at one point lived in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, quite far afield from life for most folks out in West Texas, where he had spent some of his formative years. So he's a very fluid guy, and I think a lot of times folks stop short when they think of George W. They say, well, he's not a rocket scientist. He doesn't seem to be an arching intellectual, but he's a man who has a great degree of fluidity and comfort in many different circles, and can move very, very easily in the kind of the old money upper reaches of the Northeast, and as well, he loves working the room at a stock show out in West Texas. So he's good at both, and I think he's certainly much more comfortable as a Texan. You know, his dad, when he was chewing pork rinds and was really almost chewing on glass, he didn't really like it all in all. Yeah. Richard Nixon even probably, you know, despite his faults maybe and inclinations, was, you know, obviously an astute political observer. He said of George W. Bush, you know, that guy was just never comfortable doing any of that stuff. It just never came off authentic, speaking of the elder George Bush. And George W. does like to eat pork rinds and hang out, and he's a very stylistically unpretentious guy, and I think we'll see some of that in his tenure in the White House.
Yeah. Well, it's striking that you know, as you mentioned, he went to Andover, he went to Yale, as his father and grandfather had done, but he would have just as soon stayed in Texas. He wanted to go to high school in Texas. He didn't want to go to Andover, but it sort of seemed again to be the weight of the Bush family tradition.
Yes.
The other Bushes went, so he went.
I know for a fact that George W. scoffs at this because I've heard it trickle back down, as he sometimes has heard me make the statement. But I see him in a way, really, as almost something out of Shakespeare or even Greek tragedy to an extent. This is a guy that had and again, this is divorced from how you feel about him, you know, politically. I just think, as a person, growing up in this family. And perhaps it's something that you know, we as children and parents could all relate to, that he was just burdened with an enormous level of expectations. He was the prince in waiting. He was the first son. He bears the same name as his father. He went to the same high school, college, fraternity, same secret society, Skull and Bones at Yale, same lines of work, oil, politics. He was engaged to be married at one point in his life, to a woman whom he subsequently did not marry, but he was engaged to be married to her at about the exact same time that his father, at his age in life, had chosen to be married, and many, many other parallels. He gave up drinking, as one example. He was a ferocious and sometimes over-the-top and an embarrassing drinker. Drinking was becoming a problem for George W. He gave up drinking, according to some of his friends, really in deference to his father's political wishes. I don't want to embarrass my father. I don't want to risk embarrassing my dad in his ascendancy to the presidency, so I'm going to cease drinking. When being admitted to the National Guard or undergoing the admission process to the Texas Air National Guard, the admitting officer asked George W., why do you want to join the Guard? You know, what's your reason for being here? And the first words out of his mouth were, I want to be a pilot like my father. Again, that could be debated. He might have had ulterior motives for wanting to be in the Guard, but that's what he said. And there are many, many dozens of other reference points where his entire life has been defined through his relationship with his family, with his father. And again, I see him as a guy who just tried to embrace the legacy, but at the same time distance himself from it. When he was running for Congress, a failed bid for Congress in 78 here in Texas. He was hammered hard for being a daddy's boy, for being a Yankee carpetbagger, the tool of the Eastern establishment, and on and on, but primarily accused of being a guy without a civic resume and who was simply really the next guy in the dynasty. And in exasperation one day at a debate, he just blurted out, I can't help that I was born with this name. As I worked on my biography with him, I felt some degree of sadness about that. And again, not that I think veered into moving, you know, my book off the dime in terms of it becoming an adulatory work. But I wanted to think longer and harder about his role in the family. And I did sense that in some ways, some even unspoken ways, he really has been burdened by this relationship with the family, the expectations.
We have several callers. We'll get right to them now. And again, let me just mention again, our guest is Bill Minutaglio. He's a Texas-based journalist, has worked for a number of newspapers in Texas. He's the author of the book First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. It's a biography of George W. Bush. It's published by Three Rivers Press. It's now out in paper. First came out in 1999. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. For local folks, and if it would be a long-distance call, you can use the toll-free line 800 1-800-222-9455. And we have several callers here. We'll start with line number 4. Hello?
Number 4?
Yes.
Right. I'm interested in when he beat Ann Richards for governor. What was the percentage of the vote?
When he beat Ann Richards?
Yeah.
I'd have to look up the exact percentage. It wasn't an overwhelming margin. I know the exact percentage in his second victory. It was
The first one. Like, was it like 2 points, or was it very much, or what?
Yeah, I'd have to. I'll thumb through my book and tell you that the exact number. I'll be very honest with you, is escaping me. But it wasn't as overwhelming a victory as his second victory. I hate to use that as a reference point. It's not answering your question.
And did he beat her on the crime issue?
Did he beat her on the crime issue?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think he beat her on the crime issue. It was something that he brought up. He said that he was going to make crime one of the centerpieces of his agenda. I'll tell you, my theory on why he beat Ann Richards. I think in a great lengthy process, he began to portray her as an absentee governor. And as a celebrity governor, which is an interesting tack to take for George W., who had emerged as a candidate really almost on the strength of his own celebrity, not really on the strength of his own personal civic resume. But he hammered her over and over again for being a friend of Hollywood, somebody who was out of town a lot and not in the state a lot, just somebody who was, almost an absentee a landlord, if you will, and not really taking care of the state. He also enjoyed ferocious support, frankly speaking, from my perspective here in Austin, from a backlash, I saw it anyway, among some state leaders toward a woman being in office. It's sort of almost an unspoken fact that down here, a lot of people were becoming disenchanted with the thought of Ann Richards being a powerful woman in office. And a lot of, frankly, good old boy Texas Democrats who had once been supporters of her found sort of a more chummy, macho allegiance with George W. They threw his support to her in a way, and again, I don't mean this in.
Now, was she actually gone that much, or did they? Was it?
She actually was.
She was.
I mean, and the perception was that even during the course of the campaign, political strategists have suggested that she just wasn't as engaged in the process and had kind of grown weary.
Question about people who say that the education reforms were really due to Ann Richards and Ross Perot, and they had nothing to do.
Oh yeah, no, you're exactly right. If what Bush did very cleverly, and again, I think he could almost be lauded for it, but at the same time criticized for it. Like a lot of things in the world, it's not just simply black and white. He identified successful movements in the state legislature that had been engendered or set in motion by other people, especially Ann Richards, his obvious predecessor, and then attached his name to those ongoing bits of legislation, and basically rode the train. The train was already leaving the station on many of the things, including attacks against crime, welfare reform, or the retooling of the welfare system here in Texas, education proposals, a lot of things that he presently takes credit for.
Yeah, my last question is about, when I think of George Bush, I think of somebody who got into the best schools when other people probably had much higher test scores and better records, as probably did Al Gore. And he's sort of been charmed, like he has been lucky in a lot of ways. And what do you think will happen if, like, say, if the economy becomes, like, a major problem? Has he faced major problems?
Yeah, in terms of almost a defining moment, is that what you're asking?
Well, no, in general, like, Texas, the economy in general, like owning the given, having amazing luck by having people give him stock in the sure. baseball team and being bailed out when he didn't do very well in the oil business and just a charmed life. And if, say, for the whole United States, if there are economic problems, what is he going to do? Because he's used to having things pretty easy.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the way I would frame it, the fair way, I guess, to frame it or to look at it is that really in his life, and especially in his political life, there haven't been a great, enormous set of deep, soul-rattling challenges. And, when things have tended in that direction, when there have been some dark clouds, he's had the enormous widespread support of his family. And George W. is unapologetic about it. He said, you know, I have the benefit of good friends and good family. Some of them are powerful. Some of them are influential. And again, I you know, how can I turn my back on it? They're there to help me. They're there to support me. It's not my fault that they're there for me to pull me out of the fire. So I think, to me, what will be interesting is how all of that plays out when he does have those kind of lonely presidential moments where he'll have to really reach deep inside of himself and not really seek to other people for support. It's going to be a new experience for him. I wanted to answer your first question, and I'm sorry I didn't wasn't able to sum it up the exact percentages off the top of my head, but he won by 54% to 45% against Ann Richards. So it was a fairly healthy margin.
I appreciate the caller and her questions. Let's go on to another person here. Line number one is next. Hello?
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I hate or dislike sounding like a curmudgeon. I am rather one of that clan. I'm really particularly interested in this singular marriage of Mammonism and fundamentalist Christianity, for one thing. I recall Mr. Bierce in his Devil's Dictionary defined Mammon as the god of the world's leading religion. And I think if you ask any Republican to be honest about what he really believes, he'd put Mammon way ahead of Jesus. Although the fundamentalists are somewhat more confused about all this. But, yeah, what a friend we have in Croesus.
We have a lot of callers, and we don't have very much time, so it would really help us if you'd get to your question.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'd like you to refer, make some comments about this fellow's ROTC service and his avoidance. I understand the government paid about $1 million to teach him to fly, and he avoided, he went AWOL on two assignments, probably because they were instituting mandatory drug testing. I'd like to hypothesize, this is just facetiously, I know this is probably not has little reference to reality, but when this guy's wondrous facility with the language, I was thinking maybe some mentally deficient pod person got together with some rather cute little old Yahoo gal from some cute little old Yahoo town down in the cute little old South.
Okay, I think we got the question. Mr. Minnetankler, you want to talk about George W.'s experience in
sure.
during the Vietnam period and in the Guard?
Absolutely, sure. It's you know, again, in this modern political age, all about how you interpret and how you view it. I've really become convinced. You know, the Democrats like things in black and white. The hardcore Democrats do. The hardcore Republicans like things in black and white. And like a lot of things in George W.'s life, for a guy who seems to be somewhat, you know, a guy who tells you what you see is what you get. There are a lot of gray areas, and the military service is exactly a gray area. It seems pretty evident now that George W. was afforded some assistance in getting into the Texas Air National Guard. He did not serve in a combat situation. He served in Texas in the Air National Guard. He went into a unit down there, a pilot training wing in Houston, Texas, with the full knowledge that this unit would probably never, ever be summoned to do service overseas, and that their primary duty would be to fly missions, security missions, as they were called, off the coast of Texas around the Gulf of Mexico. But it looks like someone, a close big-time oilman down here in Texas, had placed a call to a state official who was in charge of expediting admissions to the National Guard, and it looked like some calls were made and perhaps the wheels were greased. The Bushes, of course, claim otherwise. You know, we don't know that anybody helped us. If they did, we didn't want that to happen. Your caller made reference to something that did well up over the course of the campaign, a suggestion that in the course of George W.'s 5 years serving in the National Guard, that at one point toward the latter end of his service in the 1972 range, that he had simply ceased showing up for National Guard duty. The records seem to prove that he just was not there as often as perhaps he could have been. But the counterargument from the Bush camp is that he had already fulfilled the legal requirements for his attending National Guard duty and was not legally required to be there. He was honorably discharged from the National Guard. There was never any, as far as I know, wholesale investigation into where he was or why he was not reporting more often as a kind of a weekend warrior in the National Guard in the 1970s. And an examination of his military records that I obtained under the Freedom of Information Act suggests that his officers, thought well of him. He was given good grades. He was considered a good to adequate pilot. He was well-liked by a lot of his comrades in the National Guard, many of whom I interviewed. The fact remains, again, that he did not serve overseas. It does appear that someone helped gain him admission to the National Guard, and that it's very clear, again, that he wasn't putting in as much time toward the latter end of his National Guard career as some other folks were.
Let's go to line number two for someone else. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
First, we had George Herbert Walker Bush, and now we've got George Walker Bush. I wonder if you could enlighten us on who this Walker guy was.
You're asking about the Walker connection?
Yes.
Where these folks come from. I love talking about the Walkers because in a lot of ways the Walker side of the family, it's basically a marriage of two clans. The Bushes and the Walkers merged together in the 1920s, but the Walkers in some way are a far more interesting and powerful clan when you especially weigh their financial and business interests in this country. This is a powerful, dynastic family that moved with the titans of American industry, i.e. the Rockefellers, the Vanderbilts, the Astors, and the Harrimans. And the Harrimans are germane in this equation because the Walkers and part of the Bush family, too, wound up doing a lot of business with the Harrimans at one point in almost sculpting and bringing forward the modern structure of Wall Street. It's a family, the Walkers, that have enormous, deep roots into Wall Street. They really earned their money back in the mid-1800s as the country was still pushing west and cities were growing and emerging and railroads were pushing west. They kind of joined that Manifest Destiny movement in a way and helped to uncork a gigantic wholesale dry goods enterprise that began stretching really almost coast to coast. They made a lot of money there, then they moved it onto Wall Street, and then got involved in all manner of things. The Walkers were very instrumental in helping build some rather famous structures around the country, including Madison Square Garden, the Belmont Racetrack, where a leg of the Triple Crown is run every year, and put in a little bit of money into forming the New York Mets baseball team. The Walkers have been around a lot, and I found it interesting as I delved into the family history how the Bushes are predisposed, and the Walkers are, to naming their children, the next generation, after the previous generations. So hence you have, there was George Herbert Walker, then there's George Herbert Walker Bush, there's George Walker Bush, there's George Herbert Walker the third, and so on.
are they involved in the Walker's whiskey, the imported whiskey?
Not that I know of. You could be telling me something that I don't know, but I've
heard that. I was just trying to corroborate that. I don't know.
I'm not aware of. But again, I wouldn't be surprised to learn that there's some connection. Their business interests are extremely diverse and scattered around the country, and they have business ties overseas and in many different areas, and they really are the family. The Walkers, when merged with the Bushes back again in the 1920s, basically gave the Bush side of the family the financial bedrock to pursue political ambition. They funded the races when George W. and his father, the elder George Bush, began seeking investment money for their multi-million dollar oil investments. They went to the Walker side of the family and got the investment money, enormous amounts of money to invest in the oil business. And
very interesting. Let me give somebody else a chance. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. We'll go to line number three. Hello.
Yes, a couple of things. One quick thing, and then my main, like the other man, I have a hypothesis. But on the drinking, I heard someone on television say that Laura Bush told him that it's the booze or me.
Right.
That was what really straightened him up on the booze.
That's true. There was an internal dimension within the family that George W. gave up drinking on a summer's outing in 1986 to the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He had gone out there with his wife and two other couples, basically to celebrate the fact that all of them were turning 40 years old or entering their 40s at about that time. It actually happened to be the summer when George W. literally was turning 40. It's a very lavish, fancy hotel resort, and George W. liked to go out there with his Midland buddies to go golfing and so on. He apparently drank very heavily that night. Laura disapproved, as she often had in the past, regarding his drinking. He woke up the next morning, the story goes, with a raging hangover, managed to go out for a jog or run, which is something that he does religiously almost every day, came back from his run, and then announced to all of his friends that he was never taking a drink again. A guy who was there, his name is Joe O'Neill III, who's a very, very powerful West Texas oilman and a philanthropist who's donated a lot of money to Notre Dame University. I think there's a building there named after his family. Had told me that, in essence, George W., coupled up his wife's, the internal dimensions of her suggestions, you need to stop drinking. It's either Jim Beam or me is how George W. once framed it, framed what Laura had told him. But there was an acute strain on the marriage. He coupled that up with actually the hard reality that in the summer of 1986, his father was really moving the train out of the station for his bid for the presidency. And George W. was planning to join his father in Washington. He was going to move there. He was going to go to work for his father as a prominent senior advisor. He was going to be doing a lot of work with the national media. And his job, as designated by then Vice President Bush, his father, was to be a conduit to the media. George W., I want you to do... Well, actually, his job was two things. I want you to work with the media to determine who is a friend and who is a foe. But as well, I also want you, George W., to do some reconnaissance work for me in this burgeoning, mysterious movement out there that we're starting to hear more about. This is in the context of 1986, called the Christian Right. There are men out there, Pat Roberts and Jerry Falwell, the couple Jim and Tammy Faye Baker, who were starting to rattle their swords and carve out a political identity to a greater degree than anyone had ever imagined. And the Bush camp was wondering, would this group pose a threat to Vice President Bush's chances to win the presidency? George W.'s principal job, again, work with the media, be a media barometer, find out who's going to help us, who's going to hurt us, but as well, go out and find out about this Christian Right movement. Go out and be an ambassador to them. Let's build a bridge. Let's see if we can take away their votes, maybe take some votes literally away from Pat Roberts and steer them to the Bush camp. All of which led to speculation inside the Bush family that George W. gave up drinking, not just simply to, assuage his wife's anger, but as well really to mollify the Christian Right and even some members of the media who would be out there laying traps for the Bush family. That he did this enormous, personal lifestyle change in essence to help his father win the White House. It was a political decision in a way.
Can I add just a minute for this other?
If you can be quick, because I do. Okay, the lines are full, and I want to go on.
I have a theory, and I'd like to give it to you to see what you, as somebody who knows them, thinks of it. My belief is that Jeb was Barbara Bush's horse.
Mm-hmm.
That she was for him, and that I can see a little drama of George W. going to his father and saying, "I want to run for president in 2000.
Yeah,
going to Barbara, and Barbara saying no. Really, they took a tremendous, from a political standpoint, this was a bad year to run. Last year was a bad year, and it was a long shot, and I think Barbara said no, and George for once bucked his wife and went with his eldest son.
There's a lot of that dynamic in the family. The Bushes will tell you otherwise, but you're exactly right. It's something out of the Corleones in a way, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. There's a lot of infighting and tangling to to a degree among the siblings and than we'll ever know, than we'll ever be privy to. But you know, the word that I heard from friends and family again was that Najib was always considered the better political package. He's a less combustible guy. He's not prone to these Mount Vesuvius eruptions that George W. Bush on occasion can exhibit. He's a little more media friendly. George W., in essence, maybe as an outgrowth of what I described earlier, really doesn't like the media. And there were some moments when that was really nakedly revealed over the course of the campaign, when he uttered some pejoratives about some members of the national media. The sense always was that Jeb was smarter. He's more cerebral. He graduated from college in 3 years. He was a Phi Beta Kappa graduate. He was a tennis player. He had a lot of things going on. He wasn't a gentleman C student, as his older brother, George W., was. And he seemed to be politically engaged for a longer period of his life in terms of trying to build a civic resume and being involved in the lower echelon realms of public service rather than his brother, who wanted to head right to the starting gate. You know, and speaking of the starting gate, they both went to the starting gate in 94. I suspect it would have simply been a lot more interesting if both men had been elected governor that year. Jeb, unfortunately for him and any presidential ambitions that he might have harbored, lost that race, and George W. obviously won, and the Bush train again was leaving the station, but only for George W.
We have about 5 minutes left, and some other callers here. We'll try to get as many as we can. Next is line number four. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning. I don't know how to phrase this question. Maybe you can see what I'm trying to get at.
Sure.
What went on with George W. Bush that he won over McCain? And were those same forces intact that for what went on in Florida, that he won in Florida also?
Yeah, I think I know where you're headed in some way. I hope I can answer it. I don't think that George W. ever really won over McCain in a sense. I think McCain, being a soldier and a military man, realized that the winning the war was more important than winning the battle. And I think he to extend this my horrible combative analogies here, but I think he threw himself on the sword and just said, our primary mission goal here is to take back the White House, and I'll do business with George W. Bush. But it was clear to me, just being out a little bit on the campaign trail, watching the kind of day-to-day duel between these guys, that McCain really, in essence, didn't like George W., didn't like where he came from, didn't like especially the way that he was treated by the Bush campaign. Once the Bush campaign ratcheted things up a notch after the New Hampshire primary, in which McCain walloped George W., at that point, George W. called the troops together, literally, in the Days Inn Hotel in New Hampshire, and said, "The game's over. Now we're going to war. We're going to get real serious about this." And they went to promptly down in South Carolina, and really began attacking John McCain in a heavy-handed, I thought, way, and chased him out of the campaign. McCain harbors no great love for George W. I think he just realized it was important to retake the White House for the Republicans, and that was the higher mission.
I appreciate the caller's question. I hope she won't mind if I try to get one more here at least. We'll go to line two. Hello.
Yeah, thanks for squeezing me in. I just had a quick question. I was wondering if you could explain or describe the relationship of the Bush family to, like, old money, say, like in Palm Beach, and whether or not George W. Socialized much with trust fund baby type people.
Yes, no, absolutely. It's really the unspoken story of the Bush family. This is a true, first and foremost, a financial dynasty. we obviously know the familiars, the two presidents, his grandfather being a senator from Connecticut, but the Bush family was instrumental in founding Brown Brothers Harriman, the oldest, at one point, the oldest and largest investment house on Wall Street. They did, business with all of the famous, names in American industry, and have sat on the boards of the largest corporations in American history, Pan American, CBS, Prudential Insurance. George W.'s grandfather was on the board of trustees at Yale University and thus helped to dictate a lot of business decisions that the university would make. Very, very powerful. And speaking of Florida, yes, there's an enormous lineage and linkage to Florida. The elder, the senator from Connecticut, Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, upon leaving the Senate in 1963, at the exact same time, by the way, that his son was preparing to run for the Senate, that being the elder George Bush, so that there would be a continuum of Bushes in high elected office, moved down to Florida and set up a shop down there in what has been described, and I've seen this analyzed pretty in-depth, to a place called Hobe Sound in Jupiter Island, which has been described as the most expensive place to live in the world, when judging the per capita income and the median housing prices. So they're not unfamiliar with moving, and again, gilded upper-end financial circles. The miracle and marvel of the Bush family is that they've really tamped down any analysis and long-range impressions that the family is tapped into high finance and high levels in that regard. They've worked very assiduously to suggest that, hey, we're just, in some ways, the ultimate example of what Horatio Alger suggested. We could really pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. We just did it to a greater degree than anybody else. Not entirely true. I mean, they've had the benefit of a lot of prehistory. The previous generation had passed on a lot of money and networking abilities to the next generation.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, I'm sure we could keep going, but we've used our time. The book, again, if you'd like to read it, a biography of George W. Bush, is titled First Son, George W. Bush and the Bush Family Dynasty. It's now out in paper, published by Three Rivers Press, by Bill Minitaglio. He's a special writer for the Dallas Morning News. Thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate it, David. Thank you very much for having me.